Hi, the Black Talk Media Project would like to invite you to become a member of the BTR Community subscription-based social media platform. BTR Community is a platform that was set up for the listening audience of Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent Black radio network online. For just $24 per year, your subscription gives you access to an interactive space to share information with like-minded people with your privacy guaranteed. Your subscription will go a long way to help us maintain and improve our current media platforms. It will also help provide a budget so that we can begin the task of establishing localized media centers and radio stations across the United States. The best way to show your support and appreciation for what we do here at Black Talk Radio is to subscribe. Help us to help you be informed. Join BTRCommunity.com today.
The views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
The necessity. Welcome. Let's begin.
Yo, I love that intro, man. Yo, your son did his thing right there.
Thank you, brother. Yeah, it's one of my favorites too. I think it's kind of short and to the point.
Greetings, everyone. Hope you're having a wonderful evening. Tonight's show is we've already done part of it when we done Tando Radio just an hour ago. But Gullah Geechee, the history of the Ka people. Am I correct? Chi. I pronounced that right. Chi. The Chi people.
Chi, yeah.
What we would like to do is get right into a few of the articles that we had posted for the day. Brother Rise, which one would you like to start? I guess we'll go ahead on and get the get the babies out the way with this one.
Okay. Yeah, there's an article here from Speak Up Project, speakupproject.com, and it's entitled "Elite Now Bragging About Using Penis Skins Taken from Babies to Make Their Faces Look Younger." The little blurb says, "Kate Blanchett and Sandra Bullock have made headlines recently by revealing their secret to maintaining young and healthy-looking skin. The duo have nicknamed the procedure the penis facial, quote-unquote, due to the fact that the serum used in the process is derived from foreskin of Korean babies." So basically, they're taking foreskin of, and I'm pretty sure they're doing it with black people, they're just not telling us, but they're taking the foreskin from these babies, making a serum, and using the serum to create this this mask. I guess it's like a protein mask that tightens their pores and makes them look and gets rid of wrinkles, so it makes them look younger. So this is the refinement of vampirism. You know, we discussed this before, using the black body or melanated body or non-white body as a commodity to be chopped up, you know, used, abused, and for their consumption. I used to have queens that bathe in blood. I know that I saw Kim Kardashian doing a facial where they had blood all over her face. So this is stuff that they passed down from like the medieval days, that these affluent European colonizers are still doing to this day. And I think that this article just kind of, you know, and I said it before, I said that now that they have us psychosocially conditioned, to accept them doing just about anything in front of us and us not complaining or making any sort of noise about it, that they feel comfortable putting this stuff out there now. You know, you wouldn't have seen this article out there maybe 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, but they're so comfortable with everything from all the deviance and, you know, the attempts at different types of legalized pedophilia, bestiality, just all the stuff that they're into. We have been so conditioned to accept just about anything that these people do that now they're going to tell you, hey, we're taking the foreskin from your children. So when you get your child circumcised, don't be surprised, you know, Sandra Bullock or Kate Blanchett has their foreskin on their face, you know. But that's vampirism, the consumption, you know, the delectable Negro.
Well, not only that, Roz, mm-hmm. not only the delectable Negro, but for whatever odd reason, but since I don't believe in coincidences, we keep coming back to this live long enough to live forever.
Yes, without question.
We continuously come back to that where they're using us as their fountain of youth.
Without question. Yeah, we remember.
Speaking of live long enough. Oh, no, if you had something else you wanted to add to that, you by all means. I was just finna get into the article about trying to live longer might be killing us.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Go ahead, brother.
No, go ahead. That's cool.
Okay, this article comes from MarketWatch, and trying to live longer just might be killing us. Do you want to spend your life prolonging your life? That's a very, very interesting question. Article reads, Barbara Entrich has written over or co-authored 20 books, and that has after earning her and that was after earning her doctorate in cellular immunology. Her most well-known book may be the best-selling Nickel and Dimed, for which she went undercover for 3 months working at minimum wage jobs around the country, revealing how difficult it was to make a living that way. She is known for her dedication to issues of social justice, accompanied by extensive research and a biting wit. In her latest book, Natural Causes and the Epidemic of Wellness, The Century of Dying and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer, she takes on society's attitude towards aging and death and finds that many of us are working too hard to prolong our lives at any cost. Man, this article is, we're not going to get all the way into it, but it's in our thread, and you really need to check this out, because some of the stuff, I guess it goes along with too much of anything will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people are really just working themselves to death, literally. Whether it's pushing weights, running, beating their knees and the cartilage up inside of their bodies, just constantly.
Yeah. But you know what? We wouldn't have to work so hard to do that if we had a natural environment. It's the fact that we are living such unnatural lives that is forcing all of this stuff, you know, as far as our conceptualization of it, you know, because you don't see lions saying, let me go for a jog. You know, they just patrol their territory if it's a male. And if it's a female, when it's time to hunt, they hunt. When it's time to do family things, they do family things. Like, we're the only species that demarcates aspects of our lives and actually organizes our lives, or we set aside time for a specific task. You know.
Well, you got to think about the psychology, though.
Absolutely.
What we're trained to do, we don't do what's natural to us no more.
Right.
Doing those when we were living free and wild, you know, we got our exercise from whether it was hunting. For those of us who were vegetarians, you know, working the fields, the gardens, and what have you, to produce food for the for our people. So now you have to get that exercise by way of, you know, going to the gym or taking a jog on unnatural surfaces. You know, so all of these things play a part.
Yeah, it's the psychology. You know, it's like I said, it's that conditioning. Once you have that, then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and they know it. They know that. They know it. So, I mean, like, we're just conditioned to live this way, and because we do want to live as long as possible, then anything that anyone says, scientist, article, whatever, says that, hey, do, try this, you can prolong your life, we're going to try it. You know what I mean? So I think that it's just,
yeah,
you know,
no study at all.
Yeah, it's just like, just do what it. They said, let's just do it. You know, just like, it's almost like a trend, and it just trends and trends and trends of the same thing. And you know, like you said, and like they say in the article, it's killing us. You know, we're striving so hard to live forever that we're not even living in the moment. So by the time you look back, you notice that you know you're elderly, and you spent most of your time trying to do things that you hope would prolong your life. You know, so yeah, and that's on top of working and all the other things. So yeah,
right. It's a constant. It's a constant stress level.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Going into the next article, though, you want to handle this one about the China social credit?
Oh, yeah. This one's really interesting. So I know Dave kind of brought it up on yesterday's show, but I wanted to kind of not really go through it intricately, but kind of get into it a little bit more, because I think just this whole concept is going to do a lot for the movement of people, even during emergencies or catastrophic events, because we saw what they did during Katrina as far as just leaving black people to suffer whatever fate was going to befall them wherever they were left. And when you tie in this kind of social credit system, where, and this it says it here, it's a Business Insider, China's social credit system has blocked people from taking 11 million flights and 4 million train trips. So it says, I'm just going to read briefly, the social credit system in China. Okay, so it's saying the same thing there. The social credit system is used to punish citizens for bad behavior with numerous blacklists, preventing them from traveling, getting loans or jobs, or staying in hotels, and even limiting internet access. China intends to roll out a more comprehensive national social credit system in 2020, which has gained comparisons to the show Black Mirror. China's social credit system has blocked 11.14 million flights and 4.25 million high-speed train trips. The numbers from the end of April were included in a report by China's state-run news outlet Global Times, but it is unclear what offenses those targeted in the travel ban have committed. The social credit system is actually a collection of blacklists, which are more than a dozen at the national level. Each list is based on similar offenses such as misbehavior on planes and trains or failing to abide by a court judgment and determines the punishments people face, from throttling internet speeds to blocking loans. While it's not made clear which list has had so many plane and train trips blocked, a former official, Hu Yongchun, is quoted as saying the system needs to be improved so, quote, discredited people become bankrupt, unquote. And the bank, blacklist Hao is referring to is most likely involves debtors and was created by the Supreme People's Court in an attempt to make people comply with verdicts and repay their debt. The court publishes the names and ID numbers of debtors on its website. They are banned from plane and high-speed train travel and can't stay at 4- and 5-star hotels, send their children to expensive schools, book cheap hire cars, or make luxury purchases online. Some provinces play a recorded message when someone tries to call a blacklisted debtor, informing the caller that the person they want to speak with has outstanding debts. And in May, a short cartoon with the photographs of debtors' faces began playing at movie theaters, on buses, and on public notice boards with a voiceover that said, quote, come, come, look at these debtors. It's a person who borrows money and doesn't pay it back, unquote. The list of debtors launched in late 2013 with 31,259 names, and within 2 weeks has been visited 180,000 times. By December 2017, 8.8 million debtors have been added to the list, preventing 8.7 million flights and 3.4 million high-speed train trips. I'll stop there. So, now...
No, go ahead. Go ahead and finish that out, because it's not
okay,
that...
No problem.
You at the bottom now.
Okay, so... With nearly 2.5 million trips blocked in the past 6 months, either China has cracked down on existing debtors' plane travel, or many more names have been added to the blacklist. Since the debtor list was first created, state media reports repeatedly described it as the first step toward creating a China-wide social credit score expected in 2020. For now, separate pilot credit systems, credit systems are being trialed by 8 companies. One of these, Sesame Credit, is run by Alibaba affiliate Ant Financial and deducts credit points off people who default on court fines. Sesame Credit is one of the few systems that give users an actual score, and it remains to be seen whether China's national system will give every citizen a score. So that's where it ends. But I think this is quite telling, because if there's an emergency and you need to exit the country, i.e. go to Mexico, if you're near the border, and you have a social credit problem as far as your score, you will not be able to leave the country by train travel or plane travel, you know, and probably they're going to add car travel when it gets here, because China's taking over everything at this point. So ultimately, that system, which they are basically the pilot country, I think, like Dave says, that all of these so-called leaders, these celebrity figureheads, are all in one big fraternity. And now that the transition is going to China, China was basically propped up as the pilot country for this system, which is going to end up rolling out globally. I easily see that being the case. And with China, you know, buying up all this property over here, I could see that system taking full effect here, and it's going to wreak havoc on people, because there's so, especially our people, because there's so many of our people just in, you know, really dire financial situations, that when you're talking about, you know, debtors, man, and people's scores getting screwed around with because they owe money, that, you know, that's a great portion of our community, and it's going to be really bad. I remember I read an article like last year that said that the average black family, if they have any assets to pass on to their children, the median average was at most $11,000, and they said the average white family was able to pass on between $100,000 and $150,000 to their descendants. So there's that massive imbalance based on all of the vampiric theft that we've been under for the last 500 plus years. So, you know, we're naturally in a situation where this credit system will be rife to destroy the lives of average black folks. And then if you commit a crime, that lowers your score even more, because you're committing a crime. And then if you don't pay the court fees, that's a whole other thing. And remember, we already have, like Scotty's talked about this numerous times, debtors' prisons. So that's going to be it's going to be a whole other level of enslavement if we don't get rid of this system and this social credit system the way that they have it outlined. Because like they said, we've already had a social credit system here. We just haven't had one as refined and precise as the one that they've been developing and piloting in China. And once that sort of development and organizational capacity reaches here, man, it's going to be a psychological mind screw for a lot of citizens, especially those who don't have money and who are in debt due to this intergenerational theft, where, you know, our people aren't able to inherit land or property from our ancestors because it's been holistically stolen.
Yeah, man, and it's crazy, because once they start buying up all of this land in certain areas, mm-hmm. you know, they can deem that as a part of their country. You know, once you step on that particular soil, mm-hmm. then you are effectively in their country, which has all of their laws.
Yep.
Yeah, it has all of their laws and rules that govern that particular area of land. And you can see things like this kind of creeping up slowly with all of the land being bought up in Detroit. You know, mm-hmm. they are slowly, effectively closing in that area. Yeah. We're not even talking about the infrastructure that's already there. Just the fact that if you own that land, then you have to adhere to the laws that govern their land.
That sovereign government.
Oh, yeah, it's a very, very scary situation. Mm-hmm. A lot of us not even paying attention to. Hopefully we get this out. Say again?
Oh, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, sorry for interjecting, I was going to say, it's one of those things, just like I talked about when we dealt with the whole UCC laws and stuff, and how they're changing these different laws, and these things sound very innocuous on a piece of paper as some new, you know, some new statute or some new law that they write into play, It's just that it has no real meaning to us until it becomes a living document and we experience what it's really saying. You know what I mean? So this is one of those things. Nobody's going to pay attention to social credit. Ah, that's that stuff going on in China. Don't worry about that. That ain't going to come here. This is America, the land of the free. That's what we're going to hear. And then one day we're going to wake up and they're going to roll it out. And there's going to be a lot of people on that list that are going to be just devastated because everything, remember what I said, it keeps them from getting jobs. So, I mean, you can be locked out of ever getting a job because your social credit score is down. How are you going to take care of your family? Commit a crime, and then that's going to ruin you even more. So it's like the more you do, the further down the rabbit hole of hell you're going to descend. And for some people, they're never going to get out because it's going to be basically jail without being in a physical prison because your life is going to be so unpalatable. And I could see tons of people committing suicide. Tons. I could see that be early. I could see that happening.
Well, we see them doing that now, though.
Now, yep. I mean, I could see that accelerating under that system, you know? Go ahead.
Let me give this out for Brother Scotty, or put down in the comments the definition. Social credit. A noun. The economic theory that customer purchasing power should be increased either by subsidizing producers so that they can lower prices or by distributing the profits of industry to customers. Thank you for that, Scotty.
Thank you.
Remember when we first started discussing this? Oh, well, go ahead, Scott. I see you there.
I'm sorry. The reason I posted that, because that sounds a lot different than what y'all read in the article. Now,
right.
Yeah, I was going to say they've created a new meaning for social credit based on this system that they've now identified as a social credit system. That China is right now, like I said, they're like the poster children for it at this point. So it seems like now social credit is going to be a word with dual meaning. One meaning the actual textbook meaning that you just posted, and the new one meaning this new social system that they're rolling out, in which you're going to be held accountable for every little thing that they can record about you. I remember there was an article I put in our group thread where they were even dinging people for social credit for jaywalking. So if you try to cross the street against the light, I believe it was in Hong Kong, there's a light that flashes on you, and then you get sprayed with water. So every time you try to cross and the light's not your light, you get sprayed with water. Then they had another one where if you drive through particular towns, you're not supposed to beep your horn because there's silence ordinances in those particular towns. And if you beep the horn, they have special cameras that can photograph you honking your horn, and then they send you I believe it was a $14 ticket or a $16 ticket in the mail every time that you're caught doing that in those particular areas.
Okay,
so
well,
basically it's complete control of the, you know, everyone's life in almost every area.
I mean, we already live in such a system. I mean, if I jaywalk, I can get a ticket for jaywalking. If I run a red light and they got them traffic cams, I can get sent a ticket in the mail, because Charlotte used to have those. But this is my concern, is a lot of these sources are Western-based sources and white people that I just simply don't trust. And, and so I just had a cousin who just came back from China. She's lived in China for a number of years teaching English. And she just moved back here. She was supposed to come here, but she got a job offer, so she went straight to Detroit, which is where most of her immediate family lives, her brothers and sisters, because her parents are dead, my aunt and uncle. So I will ask her about this, but I have to say, though, we had to consider the sources, man, because some of these sources, they have what's the word I'm looking for? They have an interest in making China look bad, just like they talk junk about Cuba and talk all this smack about Cuba, and they don't have no freedom and all this and that and the other. That's not what I hear from people that live in Cuba or have visited Cuba. Okay, I also know, hey, they don't have homelessness in Cuba unless one chooses to live outside. But there's a home for you under that system that they have. But all of this is already present here in the United States. Now, you know, I feel like, again, if we live in a society where we are, especially if it's a society of millions of people, in China case, billions of people, there has to be a system. It just can't be a free for all and we just get to do what the hell we want to do with no consciousness or concern about how our behavior is affecting other people. So, you know, again, we should always be vigilant about these governments and what have you. But when I hear people from the United States trying to talk crap about any other country, I just point to the fact that who has the largest prison slave population in the world?
Absolutely. great comeback, and it's the fact. Yeah. It is the truth. You're absolutely right. And what one thing you said that is so accurate, too, is that the story on the ground is always different than what you're going to hear, especially in Western publications. So that you're absolutely correct as far as taking those things with a grain of salt. And matter of fact, I'm going to see if I can dig into some Chinese publications and see what their media outlets have to say about this social credit system. Even if they call it by that name, they might even have a totally different name for it. That could be a Western name for it. Like, you know, with you putting the meaning in the chat room, thank you for that too. So they might even have a totally different name for it. That could be the quote unquote Western name for it, is social credit, but over there they call it something else. So I really want to dig into that a little bit more to see about it, because I've definitely heard a lot about how it's rolling out, but like you said, everything is different on the ground. It's never what's depicted as far as just
here
the news or whatever media outlet.
Here's a source. It comes from China Copyright Media. No, China Copyright and Media .wordpress.com. This was published on January 8th, 2016. Planning outline for construction of a social credit system, 2014 to 2020. I'll just read this one line. It says, according to the overall planning outline for the construction of a social credit system issued by the state council, the social credit system will focus on four areas: honesty in government affairs, commercial integrity, societal integrity, and judicial credibility. So it says that, and I'll add this, it says media coverage has thus far focused mostly on the rating of individual citizens, which falls under social integrity. However, the Chinese government's plans go beyond that and also include plans for credit scores for all businesses operating in China. I mean, that doesn't sound so ominous to me. You know?
Yeah, you know what? It sounds like even from what you just read, it sounds like the U.S. media is honing in on one particular aspect and just blowing that up.
What stood out to me is commercial.
It's just a small section of the whole system. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
What stood out to me was the area of commercial integrity, because China don't play when it comes to these businesses or these CEOs doing something wrong. They will kill you. They will execute. Yeah. I've read a number of stories where something harmful, you know, was in the food or something or whatever product, and it affected a lot of people. They execute them people.
Yeah, my wife, working in the fashion industry, they had close ties with China, Taiwan, Taipei, and even a lot of her certain coworkers would travel over there regularly. And, you know, they loved it over there. They said it was really nice, but they did reiterate that, like, they don't mess around. Like, you are absolutely correct. They don't play when it comes to that stuff. And I remember one of the big things was that they had, I think it was, some sort of baby formula or something that had some sort of toxic chemical, and it made a big to-do. This was a few years ago. Like, there's a couple, like you said, there's a few instances where, like, these big things would come out. Like, they're making candy, and something got into the candy, and the candy was no longer, you know, viable, and people were getting sick. Like, they don't play that stuff. Like, you're absolutely correct. So, let's take a balanced approach, like you were saying, and also just get into Chinese publications to get more detail. Because it's from what you just were reading, it sounds more all-encompassing, and that that small section, basically, as far as individual people's individual credit and how it's affecting them, is what's being, you know, really exacerbated in the media here to give us this ominous impression of what's to come, when there's a whole lot more to it than just that. And then on top of that, we don't know, because even in the article that we were reading, we don't really know the circumstances under what put those people there. Even the writers of the article said that we really don't know what aspect of the credit system is what's affecting these numbers and affecting these individuals. So, you know, they're not even fully aware of what it is. They're just honing in on that one thing and blowing it up. So you're absolutely correct.
Well, I think it's the other part we have to pay attention to is that, like Scott has said, we already have these things going on here in the United States. And I think one of the reasons of why it's being pushed out there so far is because this is something that they plan on turning to.
Right.
They already have debtor's prison that's supposed to be against the law. It's supposed to be, you know,
that's my
air quotations.
Yeah.
But if they could set our minds to what's happening there, once it slides over here, there will be no backlash. Yeah.
Hey, fellas, think about it like this. Anytime you find yourself in a criminal court, and unfortunately I have found myself in a criminal court for traffic violations and whatnot, what do they always check first? What do they check?
Are you a U.S. citizen?
No. Assuming you are a U.S. citizen, what do they check? What does that judge look into?
How many times you done had that same
They look
occurrence.
At your record, okay. Right? They look at your record.
Right, to see what other offenses you may have committed.
Yes, to see how many. Because I remember one time, again, I was in the wrong. I was driving with no license and what have you, and I didn't go into court and lie about it. And I remember this judge saying, well, it appears that you got a clean record, Mr. Reed. You really don't, you know, have a lot here. And so, yes, I will grant your motion for a continuance. But they check, that's sort of the same thing like social credit.
Absolutely. Because if you had, let's say, a laundry list of different charges, they're not going to give you no leeway. So you're absolutely, but that's what I was saying. Like, Dave is correct. We've always had a social credit system. It was just never called that. It was, and the way that we are taught to think about it, rather than thinking about it systemically, we think about it on an individual instance. So, you know, in this instance, you know, my credit score is not that bad, so it's going to be okay. But then if I go to court and I have a bunch of traffic violations, it's not going to be okay when the judge sees these prior traffic violations for the same thing I'm standing in front of him for now. So there's always been a social credit system. What I'm thinking is, because of the fact that when they're exacerbating this, but it does elucidate how oppressive on a deeply personal level the system can become. And in this country, which is probably one of the most brutal as far as its oppression of its citizenry, and most importantly its black citizenry, then we could see this being applied in the most oppressive way possible, even to the point of what Jenna was saying, where debtors' prisons become the norm. Once you have that social credit score that's not holding you down and you owe these debts, now it's like, oh, it's legal now, you know. And I mean, like you said, slavery's never been abolished, but I could see them using it in the most oppressive ways possible. Just because they're already honing in on those individually unpalatable aspects of it already in our news media. To me, it's almost like a bell and whistle for the government. Pay attention to this. Pay attention to this. So once we get it, we can apply it in the same way. It's just like how, you know, you'll see white folks, you know, they'll deal with a particular subject, but it's not for the subject in that particular conversation in the news media. It's really a message to all the other white folks to pay attention to this issue. And they'll speak in code around it that we don't understand as victims, but they understand as the perpetuations, the perpetrators of our victimization. And that's what I kind of see with this. They're focusing on that because I think they want to make it that oppressive for us here. It's not worth, because that's just the American way.
Well, let's get to this next article from Free Thought Project.
Okay, which one is that?
Google.
Oh, yes. This one's crazy. So it's our Free Throw Project. Google employees now quitting as company joins Pentagon, becomes part of the war machine. So the blurb says, last month, Free Throw Project reported that thousands of Google employees were speaking out about the company's close relationship with the Pentagon and their involvement in the business of war. Initially, 3,100 Google employees signed a letter to Google CEO Sundar Pichai demanding that the company cancel an ongoing contract with the Pentagon that supported a drone program called Project Maven. So this is basically Google is getting into drones. And we all know that Google Maps, you know, they can find you just about anywhere. So if you're tying up Pentagon drones, I want to kind of look into this article a little bit more because, man, there's going to be a whole lot of domestic droning happening here. You know, I just see that becoming the case, especially with this. I could see them doing this to U.S. citizens and finding some way to justify it, regardless of the Constitution. So it says here, here we go. So it says, Project Maven is an AI system that's being developed to scan images and drone footage and identify targets. It was launched April 2017, and according to a Pentagon memo, the objective is to, quote, augment or automate processing, exploitation, and dissemination, or PED, for unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, in order to reduce human factors burden of analysis, increase actionable intelligence, and enhance military decision-making, unquote. When the issue was raised last month, Google spokesperson Diane Greene assured the concerned employees that the technology will not operate or fly drones, unquote, and, quote, will not be used to launch weapons, unquote. However, the employees saw right through this excuse and pointed out in their letter that, quote, while this eliminates a narrow set of direct applications, the technology is being built for the military, and once it's delivered, it could easily be used to assist in these tasks. This plan will irreparably damage Google's brand and its ability to compete for talent, unquote. Some of the employees who are resigning in protest have spoken with Gizmodo anonymously about their decisions. Quote, at some point I realized I could not in good faith recommend anyone join Google knowing what I knew. I realized I can't recommend people to join here. Then why am I still here? That's what one of them said. Another one said, I tried to remind myself right that Google's decisions are not my decisions. I'm not personally responsible for everything they do, but I do feel responsibility when I see something that I should escalate it, another said. Then a third person said, actions speak louder than words, and that's a standard I hold myself to as well. I wasn't happy just voicing my concerns internally. The strongest possible statement I could take against this was to leave. So you have some thinking employees who understand the overarching reality of whenever the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex gets into any technology, that it's going to be all about taking as many lives as possible. And in the world that we live in, the vast majority of those lives will probably be non-white lives. So, yeah, I think this is something to really pay attention to, because this is all just the marriage of all areas of people activity under the destruction of life forms. And we're seeing it now with this. So it's AI and the Pentagon. So that sounds similar to Skynet to me. Or even the computer from War Games.
Yeah, we discussed that on how to use drones to to liberate, for black liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And I was just saying that they was going to be using that to map out the globe. You know, just finding all of these... flying these drones over top. And then we also have to realize that they using AI with these drones that they're talking about. So you potentially have a scenario of, I can't remember what that movie was, but where the drone, it decides that whatever its human counterpart typed in there for it to do was not the right order to be taken.
Right.
So it's a lot to worry about.
I'm sorry, I was going to say that's part of what the article said, is that it's going to also be about making decisions. So this is artificial intelligence that will be making its probably life or death decisions about other human beings in some other part of the world, or like I said, part of this country, because I could really see them, you know, getting down with the domestic drones and writing some laws in place to make it legal and constitutionally sound for them to go around killing their own citizens. I just, this this corporation is capable of anything. I'll put it like that. So,
I'm trying to find the name of this movie, man, because it was actually a pretty good movie.
Is it an older movie?
Yes, it's called Stealth, 2005.
Okay.
Stealth, where okay. Jamie Foxx was he was an airplane pilot, and he flew on the side of the AI jet that they had.
Mm-hmm.
And like you were saying, it's making decisions, so it knows everything that the other pilots do, because they study them. They're linked into the system.
And it's probably reading their minds too.
You know, right now, everything's possible.
Yeah, because with those algorithms, they can literally read your mind. And I mean, I've posted articles on some of that stuff where they've been able to, you know, successfully tell what people were thinking. And they have algorithms that can do that sort of stuff. And once you're doing that, then that's where a lot of that predictive policing and all of that comes into play. Because in their mind, and it's reading your vital signs, so it can tell if you're lying or not. Based on, you know, how your body physically responds, because the body will respond autonomously to certain forms of stimuli if you're questioned or, you know, things like that. So it gets really deep and quite invasive, to say the least.
Yeah, thank you, Scotty, for that article.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
We had to dig a lot deeper into that also. We're down here at the bottom of the hour, a little past the bottom of the hour. You want to get into the rest of these articles before we get to the meat? I think you wanted to go over the food. Am I correct?
Oh yeah, this was a pretty interesting article here too. Yeah, let me get into that real quick. I'm pulling it up now. So this is mgafrica.com, and the article is "What Slaves Bought: Africa's Gift to American Cuisine: The Remarkable History of Some Humble Vegetables." How African slaves and their descendants shaped how Americans cook and eat. No one saw that coming. The transatlantic slave trade was the biggest deportation in history and a determining factor in the world economy of the 18th century. This was a time when millions of Africans were torn from their homes, trafficked to the American continent, and sold as slaves. What the Americans may not have anticipated, however, would be the huge impact of the African diet and food on their future cuisine. The effects are most notable in the southern states, where soon after their arrival, seeds were planted to feed the massive slave population, mostly those of the foods that they had been forced to leave behind. So plantation families began enjoying creations of quote-unquote African vegetable seeds and starches. Different cooking techniques also came about when slaves entered the plantation houses cooked. One-pot cooking, stews, gumbos, thickening with okra or nuts all became popular. West African cooks also prepared greens by laying meat on top, and without that influence, the southern tradition of using smoked meats as seasoning may never have begun. Revenge of the leftovers. African slaves were also only given the quote-unquote leftover and undesirable cuts of meat or vegetables from their masters, something which has influenced the style of cooking in the South today. As a result, we have seen the emergence of dishes like chitterlings or chitlins, and the cleaned and prepared intestines of hogs, slow-cooked and often eaten with vinegar and hot sauce. The cooks were also accustomed to large quantities of greens and vegetables in their diet, so when they cooked, they incorporated more of these sorts of foods into their daily meals. Some historians say that the addition of such vitamin and mineral-rich food plants saved white slaveholders from nutritional deficiencies. Here are some of the most important ingredients and dishes that came about because of this tragic movement. Rice. Most of North Carolina's economy is based on rice production, and the rice arrived in the colony as leftover subsistence food for slaves. This grain is called the Carolina Gold, quote-unquote, as a result of the crop's popularity. Africans were plucked from rice-producing regions such as Casamance, a region in the south of Senegal, to find slaves who knew how to cultivate rice, and they were then shipped to the Carolinas or Mexico. Here, there are two, quote-unquote, families of rice in the world. One of them is from Asia and the other from Africa. The African rice, whose scientific name is Oryza glabrima, is the one that arrived in the Americas on the slave ships, jambalaya. Rice is the key ingredient in jambalaya, created in Louisiana, though its true roots are hard to ascertain, though the African influence is certainly there. Many believe that its originator was from the rice dishes of West Africa, such as jollof rice or theo boudin, the national dish of Senegal. The common ingredients are there: rice, tomatoes, onion, bell peppers, tomatoes, and fish or meat. But versions of this one of these one-pot dishes travel from place to place, with the slaves and settlers being adapted to local ingredients and preferences along the way. Black-eyed peas. Black-eyed peas traveled to the America by slaves who worked on the plantations. They traveled from Africa as food for the enslaved, and the seeds were also planted in Jamaica to grow food. It was eventually grown in North Carolina in 1714 and in Virginia by 1775. As it grew more popular, it even became a traditional dish served on New Year's Day to bring good luck. Hoppin' John. The good luck dish was called Hoppin' John, with both rice and black-eyed peas available. The natives of West Africa could prepare a dish that reminded them of home, a humble combination of rice and beans that became a widespread tradition. Couscous. Couscous, tiny granules made from steamed and dried durum wheat, plays an important part in the Louisiana diet, served with yogurt at breakfast or part of an evening meal. It was first introduced into America by Senegambian slaves, served with green and leafy sauce. Okra, like other crops, okra was probably brought to be cultivated as cheap foodstuffs to feed the burgeoning slave population. Okra may have been introduced into southeastern North America in the early 18th century. By 1748, it was grown as far north as Philadelphia and was well established in Virginia by 1781. Gumbo. Gumbo originated in Louisiana and is probably the region's most famous dish. This popular stew or soup is made up of vegetables mixed with chicken, pork, shrimp, or crayfish, with okra as the main ingredient. In fact, the dish likely derived this name from either the Bantu word for okra, which is ki in gumbo, suggesting that gumbo was originally made with okra. Watermelon. Food historians believe that African slaves helped introduce the watermelon, now the most consumed melon in the United States. The fruit eventually became a major symbol in the iconography of racism in the United States through the quote-unquote watermelon stereotype in various images. The fruit was used to paint African Americans as simple-minded people who were happy when provided watermelon and a little bit of rest. Collard greens, or kale, also known as sukumawiki to some of us, has been cooked and used for centuries. The southern style of cooking greens came with the arrival of African slaves to southern colonies. Though greens did not originate in Africa, the habit of eating greens that have been cooked down into a low gravy and drinking the juices from the greens, known as pot liquor, is of African origin. And lastly, the sesame seeds. The Bantus of West Africa call sesame seeds bene, and they are still sometimes known by that name in South Carolina, especially when referring to popular cookies made with sesame seeds called bene seed wafers. The seeds first arrived in South Carolina from Africa in the 1730s and were eaten as food or pressed for oil. An American merchant introduced sesame seed oil to England in 1730, and the product became a profitable New World substitute for the imported olive oil used for cooking. So that's that.
Man. Southern home cooking, man.
Yeah.
Never know where that's where it comes from.
Yeah.
Say again?
No, I said you're absolutely correct, man, because it's interesting. The gumbo dish and jambalaya, there's a dish we have in Trinidad that we call pilau, which is like it's rice and pigeon peas, stewed chicken, carrots in there, onions, garlic, and a bunch of seasoning, and it's all in one pot. So like it reminds me of these dishes. So it's all coming from a similar source. We just all been dropped off at different places, but the connections culturally, especially through the food, are quite fascinating to me. But yeah, it's a really good article. So yeah. So did you want to get the? But then again, we're coming up on the hour now, so we have to take a break and come back. So let me see. I think I might just. Should I get into that Ethiopians in South America? Because we could probably get into that a little bit, then go to the break, and then really get into the rest of it.
Yeah, because we're a little pressed for time on this particular.
Yeah, so I'm not going to read the whole thing.
I think that'd be best.
Yeah, I'm just going to read excerpts, not the whole thing. Okay, let's see.
Do you have it?
Yeah, I have it up now. I'm just trying to find what I'm looking for. Okay, so this section is talking about the connection between Peru and Ethiopia. So it says, and this is from ancientorigins.net, and it's entitled East African Invasions in South America, Tracing Cultural Clues and Artifacts Left by Early Travelers. And this is speaking of the Ethiopian presence in the region of the Andes. And this section here says, in Peru, large double-deck boats are depicted on ceramic pots, which are almost identical to the papyrus reed boats used in Proto-Sahara and in Planitia. Water jars and other cargo are painted on the lower deck of the boats, along with rows of people. An earthly representation of the sun god Ra stood on the upper deck, the same as the sun god of Meroe in Egypt, surrounded by birdmen who handled the rope and propelled the ship through the water. The interesting thing about these pictures is that they're almost exact replicas of scenes depicted in Egyptian pyramids. So, and they say there are other similarities between Ethiopia and Peru. Ethiopians used battle clubs in war, and their doctors became skilled in trepanning, cranial surgery without killing the patient. This operation was unknown to Europeans until after Columbus discovered America, yet it was known to the Peruvians. Both groups also used false heads on mummies. Peruvians and Ethiopians also used horizontal looms staked out on the ground, along with a vertical frame loom with two warp beams. Von Hagen noted that, quote, a form of backstring loom was used in Egypt. A horizontal loom appears in pre-dynastic Egypt, and one pictured on the tomb of Khnumhotep at Beni Hassan circa 1900 BC is identical with those of the Andean and coastal Peruvians. Ethiopian explorers probably reached Peru and Ecuador by accident. Chinese records make it clear that Aksumites made many long voyages across the Pacific and Indian Oceans. These sailors traveled mid-ocean, not near the shore. A group of Ethiopian merchants, probably on a voyage to China, Sri Lanka, or Malaysia, or on a military campaign to put down a rebellion in one of their Indian Ocean colonies, may have been captured by the equatorial countercurrent in their papyrus boat and carried to Peru, Ecuador. Since they were usually prepared for voyages up to 5 years long, these hypothetical voyages would have possessed the supplies necessary to make the long trip. So they have early depictions of Aksumite Ethiopians in South America. The Aksumites probably landed in a sparsely populated areas in Peru and Ecuador. They would have met little resistance from the local Amerindian groups who saw them as giants. The Aksumites' experience building underground dwellings made it possible for them to construct safe habitation complexes and later set pyramids to bury their elite. As in Meroe, Peruvian pyramids were made of bricks of sun-dry clay mixed with straw, using the same formula as Egyptians and Ethiopians. They're not talking about Egyptians. It's Nubians and Ethiopians. They're not Egyptians. Ethiopian Peruvian adobe was made in a rectangular mold, just like in Ethiopia. So this article just really gets into all of the different things. They even found Ethiopian crosses on Peruvian temples, and they have images of them there, including the image of the boat with Ra riding in the boat and the papyrus reed boat. So it's a lot of great information just showing that the Ethiopians had been coming here for a long time. And obviously, in this particular period, the Aksumite period, which is later in Ethiopian history, they had contact with Peru and Ecuador. And the artifacts are there. They have images of African elephants and mountain gorillas and all kinds of stuff that they found over there that could have only come with these Ethiopian settlers, travelers who made their way there. So yeah, and that's just one of many visits that they've made here BC
yes, and that transition. My apologies, go ahead.
No, go ahead, that was it, you go ahead.
I was gonna say that transitioned us to what we're gonna start into at the top of the hour, into the Chi people.
Yeah, did you want to go to the break now, and then that way we could just come back? I mean, we still have a couple of minutes. But yeah, I'm thinking let's just get the break out the way now.
If you're there, Scatter, you'll hit us up.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Yes. Welcome back. This is Real Life with your hosts, Roz and Jenna. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to add to anything that we've discussed about, give us a call. That number is 704-802-5056. That number again is 704-802-5056. Press star to put yourself in the queue, and we'll get with you as soon as possible. Now we have one more video, Scotty. When do you want to get into that video, Ross?
Do that now. Just get that out the way.
Yeah, let me bring this down for you, Scotty. I don't know if you should.
I'm here to prove that purple mattress early. Blows memory foam.
Thank.
I just put it back in the chat room too.
Okay.
21 points proving blacks were in ancient America before Mongoloids and Columbus. Point number one. The first Americans, the Paleo-Americans, were blacks. This reality is based on the skeletal remains of Nia and Luzia. Nia and Luzia were Negroes or blacks. Point number two. Black Africans, according to researchers, have been in Brazil since 100,000 BC. Evidence that fire existed in Brazil 65,000 years ago is an indication that man was at the site 65,000 years ago. Since researchers found charcoal, which is a result of fire making, the New York Times reported that humans were in Brazil 100,000 years ago. If you would see the New York Times video, you would note that Dr. Nidra Guidon supports her dating of human population of Brazil 100,000 years ago due to finding ancient fire and tool making. Point number three. The original Maya, beginning with the Ocos, is illustrated by their art were black Native Americans. The Mayans were originally black Native Americans. The ancestors of the original Maya were Paleo Americans. In beliefs around 2500 BC, we see evidence of agriculture. The iconography of this period depicts Africoids, and at Izapa, in 1358 BC, astronomer priest invented the first American calendar, in addition to numerous sculptures of blacks dating to the second millennium BC. All of these blacks have been found throughout Mexico, at La Venta, Chiapas, Teotihuacan, and Teotihuacan. The earliest culture founded by blacks was on the Pacific coast. This culture was called Mocaya. The Mocaya tradition was situated on the Pacific coast in Mexico in the Soconusco region. Sedentary village life began as early as 2000 BC. That's right. By 2000 BC, blacks in Mexico had developed a very sophisticated culture. Between 1700 and 1500 BC, we see many other African communities in Mazatlan region, and this culture was called the Bara phase or Ocos phase. During the Bara phase, these blacks built villages and made beautiful ceramic vessels, often with three legs. They also made a large number of effigy vessels. The figurines of the Ocos are the most significant evidence for blacks living in the area during this period. The female figurine from Achilles Cerdan is clearly that of an African woman. See, here's an Ocos female. The blacks of the Mocaya tradition were not Olmec. The civilization in the Mocaya tradition began 700 years before the Olmec arrived in Mexico from Africa. Here's a picture of one of the Xhosa people who lived in Mexico before the Olmecs. In most history texts, the Ocos are presented as the original founders of Mayan civilization. As you can see from the art, they do not look like Native Americans. They look like Negroes, like other Africans. The Mongoloid Mexicans do not look like the Olmecs either. Point number four. The black Native Americans lived from Chiapas to Belize, Guatemala, and Honduras. Quatrefages and Rapanisque wrote about these blacks. They are called the Negro Costa Chicanos. The Negro Costa Chicanos claim that they have never been slaves and are indigenous to Guerrero and Oaxaca, on the Pacific coast of Mexico. The 1990 Mexican census recorded 66,000 Negro Costa Chicanos. These Mexicans live in African-style huts and practice rituals, which may be of African origin, but most probably go back to the original blacks that lived in the area as early as 2000 BC. Most researchers believe the Negro Casa Chicanos are descendants of Maroons, or runaway slaves. But none of the blacks of Costa Chica have songs about slavery and its hardships. The Negro Costa Chicanos said they are not, they insist, the descendants of African slaves. There was never slavery here, even in ancient times, and I quote. Bobby Vaughn noted that he found no consciousness of slavery among people in Costa Chica. Another researcher noted that housewives in San Jose, Estancia Grande, and Santiago Tapestla in Costa Chica say their ancestors did not come from Africa, but their families have always lived right here. And this can be supported by the statues of the Ocos, the Cheras, and other ancient black artifacts that I've shown you earlier. Point number five. The Olmec came from West Africa. They spoke the Mandi language. The tradition of Mexican Indians make it clear that the founders of some civilization in Mexico came from the east and arrived in Mexico as a result of a shipwreck. This is interesting because Bobby Vaughn said that the Negro Costa Chicanos claimed that they arrived in Mexico as a result of shipwrecks. The stella number five from Izapa makes it clear the Olmecs arrived in Mexico by boat. Here is stella number five. The fact that stella number five depicts 12 roots as part of the tree of life support the Mexican tradition that the Easterners who brought civilization to Mexico came in 12 waves. And if you notice, the roots extend into the water. The Mexican traditions that support the spread of Olmec from the east coast of Mexico to the west coast make it clear that the Olmec lived in Oaxaca and Guerrero, in addition to Veracruz. The fact that the Olmec mentioned coming to America by boat may explain the Negro Costa Chicanos claim that they arrived in America as a result of a shipwreck and never were Spanish slaves. Point number five, the Olmec spoke a Mandi language. Using the Vai language, I was able to decipher the Olmec language. As a result, we can read many of the great inscriptions that these Olmec left us. These inscriptions tell us much about the civilization of the Olmec people and their religion and culture. As a result of the Olmecs playing an important role in the rise of civilization in Mexico, we find that many Mexican languages also have Mandi languages as their roots. The Mayan and Mandi languages share vocabulary items and culture terms, as illustrated in these charts. Number six, the Khoisan took mitochondrial DNA haplogroups mtDNA L3MN and Y haplogroup E to Eurasia and the Americas. Point number seven, there are no pure Mexican Indians. Liskin noted that between 5 and 50% of Indian genes are African genes in Mexico. He wrote this article in Indigenous Populations of Mexico, Medical Anthropology, the work of Ruben Liska. As a result of the Mexicans carrying so much African blood, that's why you find many Mexicans that look like Africans or Negroes, and why many Mexicans favor the Olmecs, who were Africans. Point number eight, the Meshi, Zenu, Wayuu, and other African groups carry YAP plus associated AG transition at haplotype YDYS271. This YAP is of African origin. Point number nine, the Indian Y haplogroups C and D show African admixture at the locus of haplotype DYS271. Point 10. The American haplogroups A and B are part of the haplogroup N micro haplogroup. The Shao and Chantel at Campeche carry RM173, E1B1B, haplogroups K and T. All of these haplogroups are of African origin. Point 11. Africans carry mtDNA-A. mtDNA-A is common to Mongoloid Native Americans, and white chromosome R is common to many North American Indians. As a result, we find that many of these genes are of African origin, and in fact, you'll find that Africans in Africa carry mtDNA-A. Number 12, the Spanish explorers mentioned black nations and black tribes in the Americas they met, even before African slaves were landed in America. Point number 13, the Spanish said the Aztecs were blacks. Point number 14, Paul Gaffarel noted that when Balboa reached America, he found negre veritables, or true blacks. Balboa noted, and I quote, Indian traditions of Mexico and Central America indicate that blacks were among the first occupants of that territory. This is why so many Africans have African faces. This is why so many Mexicans have African faces. Point number 15. Vasco da Gama is said to have found information about the West Indies from Ahmed B. Majid, whom he met along the west coast of Africa, according to Bazan, in an article he wrote called Latin America, the Arabs, and Islam. This was published in the Muslim World in 1967. Point number 16. Majid wrote a handbook of navigation on the Indian Ocean, Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, and the Sea of China. Some people even claim that Majid wrote a handbook on how to travel in the waters of the West Indian Islands. Point number 17. Africans had the boats capable of sailing to the Americas. For example, Abubakar, the king of Mali, led thousands of Africans to settle America in 1310 AD. Point number 18, black native Mayan people have left iconography in the sub-pyramids of Tikal, San Bartolo, and Xuthun murals, which depict the creators of these monuments as Negroes or blacks, not Mongoloid Mayan. The most exciting archaeological find has to be the Xuthun murals. The Xuthun murals depict not only black Mayan royalty, but also Mayan commoners and elites. Here you can see some of the black architects and engineers that built the Xuthun pyramids. These colorful illustrations are by Heather Hurst. The illustration of Dr. Hurst of the Xuthun figure shows the black people have dressed in bright colors and wore various scarves and other hats to cover their hair and heads. Here again is the picture of the architects and engineers that built Xuthun. Interestingly, the stylized reproduction of black Mexicans from Bonampak murals at Chiapas, Mexico, are also colorful. The colorful outfits of the Latin Americans that were worn at Bonampak also are worn today by Africans who live in that area today. Point number 19, ancient Mayan skeletons carry sickle cell. Sickle cell anemia is a disease that strikes only African or black people. As a result, the fact that you find Mayan skeletons that carry the sickle cell trait, the sickle cell disease, indicates that these Mayas were Africans because only Africans or black people have sickle cell. Point 20, there are no pure Mex Indians. There's a high frequency of African mestizo admixture ranging between 20 to 40%. The admixture rate between Africans and indigenous Mexican Indians ranges between 5 to 50%. Some mestizos may hate themselves. Their light and white skin betrays their origin as the products of white, French, Spanish, and German men who exploited their black and Mongoloid grandmothers to make the mestizo raza, or mestizo race. Many mestizos declare Viva la raza, when in reality, their faces and features tell the story of exploited indigenous black and Mongoloid women who are raped to satisfy the sexual desires of their white fathers, who murdered the husbands and lovers of their poor, mistreated, and abused indigenous grandmothers. Mestizos, like their grandfathers, seek to steal the history of black Native Americans because they are ashamed that their real history is the history of the criminals and sexual deviants who made their race mestizo. That is why when they say Viva la Raza, they are celebrating the rape and exploitation of the indigenous black and mongoloid people. To be proud of mestizo heritage while denying the history of the black indigenous Americans is just them paying homage to the evil history of their white grandfathers. Point 21. The black Africans took their writing systems with them to America. The first Africans to introduce writing to the Americas were the Olmecs. They took writing to Mexico around 1200 BC. The first researcher to recognize that the Olmec writing was Mandi was Leo Viner, an African discovery of America. He recognized that the writing on the Tuxtla statuette was written in Mandi characters. Here you can see some pictures of the relationship between the various Olmec inscriptions and Mandi inscriptions in Africa. For example, Muara, Stella, the Tuxtla statuette. Many of these blacks continued to use the Vite script to write into Mayan times. The Vite script was also taken to America by the Mayan explorers led by Abubakar in 1310. They left inscriptions across the United States. Slave trade, African slaves used traditional writing systems to communicate with each other. For example, the Djuka, who I believe speak a Creole language with an Akan dialect substratum. The Djuka had their own writing system in Suriname, as you can see in these pictures. Herskovitz also recorded some Djuka texts. Kay Howe did considerable research on the Djuka script, and they were both able, in a sense, to show this beautiful script of ancient Suriname. As you can see, there's 21 points. Here I only provide 21 points showing the fact that the civilization that we call Mexican civilization was a civilization developed and founded by black people. These black people had been in the Americas for 100,000 years. These black people were here then, they were here when Columbus came, and they're here today. Viva la raza africana.
Okay, that's the end of the thank you for playing that.
Excuse me, sorry.
My fault, I was over here looking at the chat.
Oh, okay.
It's a lot going on, brothers. Where would you like to start at?
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, because I'm looking at these, and I agree with you on that with the sickle cell and some of these diseases, Scotty. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they go about. Okay, brother, Rise.
Yeah. Okay, so We could just definitely clarify that because, yeah, the sickle cell trait definitely does not only appear in African people. I think the oldest traces of it, because they really develop in areas where you have malaria. So any area where you have malaria, the native people to that particular area tended to develop the sickle cell trait as a defense because that particular trait would protect them from that particular illness. So you'll find that people who live in those regions are people who will have the sickle cell trait. If I remember correctly, I could be wrong. I think the oldest vestiges of that particular illness were found amongst Africans as far as our tropical origin, and we would have had probably the longest contact with that particular illness, but it's definitely not strictly an African illness per se. So yeah, that Scotty got that totally correct. And
well, I think the first thing that he put was the most important well, it's actually the second, I believe. All people on Earth carry African genes because that's where life originated.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, that as far as human life, yes, that is correct. And he even said the Mongoloid, he gave the actual haplogroups that the Mongoloid Native Americans carried, and even they were actually black as well. The original founding dynasty of China, the Shang dynasty, they used to write in them in the history books as having skin that was black as night and oily. So they had, basically, they were what Dr. Wilson would call crystal black, but they had features similar to the San people, or Khoisan people of South Africa, which is, they're one of the groups on the African continent who aren't mixed with Asians but yet carry their features, and it's just due to where they live, as far as just that desert environment with the blowing sand and things like that. The epicanthic fold protects their eyes. Matter of fact, my master teacher who passed away, who initiated me, he's from Burkina Faso, and he's crystal black, and he also has what you would call, you know, Asian eyes, but he's unmixed as well. And he's in a sub-ethnic group of the Dogon people known as the Gourmanch people. And you know, you see him, and he's crystal black, but he has so-called Chinese-looking eyes. You know, so, yeah, that all of those traits you'll find all over the continent, the traits that you find in other racial, quote-unquote racial slash ethnic groups, you'll find all over the continent in some form or fashion, because that's where they all came from. It's just, you know, these things develop for different reasons, sometimes environmental, other times it's just genetic mutation. So, yeah, that's something I could just attest to personally, because I remember when I first met him, I was kind of tripped out about that, because, you know, I'd asked him about that and we talked. So, yeah, and, you know.
Well, I know you wanted to get into race and history, and we're 15 minutes from the bottom of the hour. So we're going to get right on into the meat of this.
Yeah, let me see. I got the... Okay, so I pulled it up here. Let me see. So this is... it's called Black Civilizations of Ancient America, Mulan or Mexico, also known as She. Gigantic Stone Heads of Negritic Africans During the Olmec She Civilization. This is by Paul Barton. And he's a historian. I actually have a book of his dealing with the Olmec that I'll probably be reading a little bit out of as well. So it says, the earliest people in the Americas were of the Negritic African race, who entered the Americas perhaps as early as 100,000 years ago by way of the Bering Strait, and about 30,000 years ago in a worldwide maritime undertaking that included journeys from the then wet and lake-filled Sahara towards the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, and from West Africa across the Atlantic Ocean towards the Americas. So it says, according to the Gladwin thesis, this ancient journey occurred particularly about 75,000 years ago and included black pygmies, black Negritic people, and black Australoids, similar to the aboriginal people of Australia and parts of Asia, including India. And then this section is entitled Ancient Africa Terracotta, African Terracotta Portraits, 1000 BC to 500 BC. Recent discoveries in the field of linguistics and other methods have shown without a doubt that the ancient Olmec of Mexico, also known as the She people, came originally from West Africa and were of the Mende African ethnic stock, according to Clyde Winters and other writers. The Mende script was discovered on some of the ancient Olmec monuments of Mexico and were found to be identical to the very same script used by the Mende people of West Africa. Although the carbon 14 testing date for the presence of black Olmec or She people is about 1500 BC, journeys to Mexico and the southern United States may have come from West Africa much earlier, particularly around 5000 years before Christ. That conclusion is based on the finding of an African native cotton that was discovered in North America. Its only possible manner of arriving where it was found had to have been through human hands. At that period in West African history, and even before, civilization was in full bloom in the Western Sahara in what is today Mauritania. One of Africa's earliest civilizations, the Xing Empire, existed and may have lived in what it was a lake-filled, wet, and fertile Sahara where ships crisscrossed from place to place. So just to give the context, they're talking about what's known as the African aqualithic civilizations, and these were the major lakes was Lake Chad, which was like hundreds of times bigger than what it is now, and then the other lake was Lake Chad, and I think the other lake was called Lake Congo, and they were two mega lakes. And these two lakes were where Africans perfected their boat building skills and their navigational skills before they took to the high seas. So basically, these two lakes were so big, they were like inland seas of fresh water, basically, in the continent. And this was around when they're talking about the Fertile Sahara. So you're talking about anywhere between 12,000 and 6,000 BC was when the Sahara was green. It was around 6,000 BC was when the drying basically was completing, and at that point the people who were in the Sahara then migrated to the what they call the foothills of the Mountains of the Moon, or the origins of what became the Nile River. And then they started at the beginning of the river and followed the river all the way down and created civilization all along both the Blue Nile and White Nile. And a lot of people don't know there was also another Nile River called the Yellow Nile, which came from the west, and that one is almost completely dried up. It's just like a small section of it that still works, that's still running today. And there's a specific indigenous Nile crocodile species that's endemic to that area that's going to go extinct probably in the next 10 to 20 years because there's not many of them left, and the river that they use is drying up. So you have these civilizations all coming up in the Nile and blossoming into what became known as the Kemetic civilization. So ultimately, that's when he's talking about the navigational skills, that's where it was developed, was in those inland lakes. And then once the Sahara dried up, and even before it dried up, they were already taken to the high seas because the Atlantic Ocean was known as the Ethiopian Ocean, and actually, as was the Indian Ocean, it was also known as the Ethiopian Ocean as well. But we'll get into that later. So let me see here. So, right now I'm
sharing my screen, and I wanted to discuss a little bit about these pyramids. On that same thing, for those of you that are viewing, we're looking at racing history as what Ross was just reading from, and it shows the Mesoamerican period with stepped appearance about 2,500 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then the Shakara, Egypt built the step pyramid of Shakara, Egypt, built over 4,000 years ago. And mm-hmm. one of the things that we don't find in the Americas, well, as far as these gigantic pyramids, is that we don't find nowhere where they perfected the craft of building. Could you add some more to that, Brother Ross?
Well, yeah, there's some great information in a few books on that, but the pyramid building culture that was here was happening at the same time the pyramid building culture in the Nile Valley was at its height. And also you had the direct correspondences when they found the cocaine in Ramses III's mummy and another noble by the name of Senatali, and there was a few, if I remember correctly, there were a few hundred mummies where they found these traces of nicotine and from tobacco and cocaine in these mummies, and it just proved direct contact between the Nile Valley and here. So this was all happening during the same time. So the people who came from there, because you had the West African group, the Mende people, the Dogon had come here as well, and there were quite a few other West African groups that made their way over here before Columbus. And then you had the Nile Valley groups from Nubia and Ethiopia that also came here as well. And one of the other things that they utilized, I remember with Dr. Van Sertimer, was the Perry Reese map, which actually showed the Americas, and it was a map found in Egypt by a Turkish. I think he was like some sort of I guess you could say like an archaeologist or something. And actually, the Perry Reese map was a copy of an even older map, but that was a map that depicted the Americas, Antarctica, and everything. And he has a picture of the map in the book that came before Columbus. And yeah, so there was contact between the two places. And then also even the watermelon. The watermelon's origins come from the Nile Valley region, in Sudan or Ethiopia area. So ultimately, the connections are there just through most specifically the cocaine and mummies. But there's also artifacts here. There's Egyptian temple names in Colorado, and all over that area you have different Egyptian temple names. They found even there's an Aztec temple, and I posted the article on that like a few months back, where they have like a giant ankh in the middle of the temple, and it's like isolated by itself, and it's like a giant stone ankh there, which only comes from the Nile Valley specifically. I remember Dr. York had a picture of a statue, and it was one of the Olmec statues, and it had a belt, and in the middle of the belt where the buckle would be was an ankh. And I was like, yeah, so the cultural symbols are there, the use of the jaguar, because they didn't have leopards here. So the leopard in Africa would be the sacred cat that they would utilize, and you can find the use of the leopard skin smock all over the Nile Valley, and actually all over the continent. But then over here, since they didn't have leopards, they used the jaguar in the same capacity. And then in Zixlahuaca, which is a cave in Mexico, they found a priest wearing the leopard smock performing the opening of the mouth ceremony on another black male wearing a white tunic. And it's identical to the opening of the mouth ceremony that's practiced in the Nile Valley to basically wake up the deceased in the world of the dead and give them the ability to hear, speak, use its mouth, and actually travel in the world of the dead. That's the ceremony you go through. And they have the identical ceremony here. Dr. Mansurma also has that. I believe that's in his book, America Revisited, if I remember correctly. But there's like the direct images where you can see both of them side by side. And the oldest of the two came out of the Nile Valley. So yeah, there's tons of different cultural references, and the use of many identical objects, sacred objects, and things of that nature too. So yeah, was there any other questions you had about that?
Yes, man. Scotty asked a wonderful question. That's fine. It was about the Amazonians, the people who had no outside contact with anybody, you know. Okay. And like he stated, they don't look African. And I must say, I don't know. The closest thing that I have that comes to mind would be the people of Portugal, once they started maneuvering around, because they were sailing as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't have an idea. I really don't.
Well, to me, because a lot of the Indians that you find that are the uncontacted ones, they tend to be of Mongoloid Asian stock. When you look at them, their features, they don't have Negroid features. And from what I've just been able to, just looking at them, they are some of them are very heavily melanated, but they have Mongoloid features to them. They don't have, like Scotty said, they don't have African features. So one thing you find with a lot of those groups is that they usually migrated deeper and deeper into the forest to escape having contact with other outside people. So sometimes you'll find that they'll migrate to their present location from other locations because the original location was overrun. And so in other words, to just avoid any contact with outsiders, they'll just move deeper and deeper into the forest until finally they're boxed in, because there's so many hundreds of thousands of acres that are lost in the Amazon each year. So a lot of these groups end up, you know, I remember there was pictures of one group that where the helicopter was hovering above them, and they were shooting poison tipped arrows at the helicopter because they were just cornered. Like literally they had gone ran as far as they could run, and they had destroyed so much of the surrounding forest that the area seemed to be big, but by the standards of what they needed to live, it wasn't that big at all. And that particular tribe, they said, was on like their last legs. I think they had less than 100 members left, and they were predicting like...
Hey, well, let's hold that thought right there. Mm-hmm. Let's hold that thought right there. We're at the bottom of the hour.
Okay.
And it is time for us to take us a break. You are listening to Real Life, the radio show. We'll be back with you in just a few seconds.
Hi, the Black Talk Media Project would like to invite you to become a member of the BTR Community subscription-based social media platform. BTR Community is a platform that was set up for the listening audience of Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent Black radio network online. For just $24 per year, your subscription gives you access to an interactive space to share information with like-minded people with your privacy guaranteed. Your subscription will go a long way to help us maintain and improve our current media platforms. It will also help provide a budget so that we can begin the task of establishing localized media centers and radio stations across the United States. The best way to show your support and appreciation for what we do here at Black Talk Radio is to subscribe. Help us to help you be informed. Join BTRCommunity.com today.
Make Black Talk Radio your choice for digital black radio. New black media for the new millennium.
Welcome back to Real Life, the radio show. If you have a question or comment, or you would like to add something, maybe something that just happened. I was just looking at Trump done is changing Obama era. He's changing Obama era laws to where these hunters can go and trap different type of game, whether it be feeding bears so that they could kill them. Mm-hmm. It's getting ridiculous, kind of like you was talking about the crocodile, but I'm looking at this Survivor International what Scotty just put up.
Hey, I do have a question.
Go ahead, Scotty.
Yeah, well, it's not really a question, it's a comment, because I'm a stickler for words. And just trying my best to use words according to the common definition. I don't like to make up definitions, because how do you know if I use an existing word and I got a different definition from yours, then we're not going to be on the same page. That's going to be some miscommunication because we got different definitions. And I only started questioning this year. The use of the word indigenous and the use of the word aboriginal, people use it interchangeably, but it don't mean the same thing.
Yeah, we talked about that before.
My understanding of the definition of the word indigenous has led me to believe that the only indigenous people on the planet live in Africa. If that's the cradle of life, if that's where all humankind originated from and migrated out to the rest of the world, then that's the only place where mankind is indigenous. Because when you look at the definition or some of the examples for indigenous, they talk about indigenous plants. Plants that only grow on a certain continent in a certain geographical location that's found nowhere else. Unless somebody has taken it there, or indigenous animals. When we hear about invasive species of animals like boa constrictors in Florida, they're not indigenous to Florida. There's people had them as pets and let them go. And now they're thriving in that tropical environment, but they're not indigenous. And so I find a lot of people using the word indigenous when they ought to be using the word aboriginal, because the definition of aboriginal
is too, because that means to spring up from the earth, and the only people that have sprung up from the earth are on the continent of Africa. That's what all those people are.
And aboriginal means the earliest people to settle a particular land,
right? Absolutely. And we've talked about this off air and on air before, so I understand exactly what you're saying. That's been a major thing that's been happening for a while now, is that these words, like you said, they are used interchangeably, and that the people who are using them aren't really understanding the meaning of the terms. They're just using the terms because I think they've heard them before in certain contexts, so they're getting an implied meaning and running with what they think the implied meaning is.
An example, yeah. Ross, somebody said something about Malcolm X using the word Aboriginal to refer to black people.
Yes.
And then saying that, you know, that see, even Malcolm knew we was indigenous. No, that's yep. not what Malcolm was saying.
Exactly.
What Malcolm was saying is that we have been here for a very long time. He was not mm-hmm. saying we are not African descendant people. That's not what he was saying. Again, because people are using two words.
And then they made up a narrative around it to make it seem like Malcolm was on the same thing they were
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
But if you listen to the rest of the quote, he actually is making a direct connection to Africa. If you pull up his OAAU site, he tells you all throughout that site that the whole intention is to create a bond and connection from politics to economics and everything else between black Africans here in America and black Africans in Africa. That was one of his main premises. So anyone who has ever said that is taking them completely out of context and actually lying on the grandfather, because like you said, he never said that there was no connection to Africa. He just said, and matter of fact, what he did say is that you guys don't want to be Aboriginal, you want to be American. And he used the term American, meaning like your oppressor, basically. You want to do the same things they do, you know, just that it's you doing it and not them. And that's pretty much what he is, the part of what he implied in what he said. But like you said, he made a direct connection to the continent. And all you got to do is go to his site, and he lays it all out as far as what his understanding of reality is and where his heart and mind was as far as what the aspirations for the global African populace should be, which was to unite and form coalitions with each other where we help each other on every level possible, so we did not have to depend on our colonizers wherever they may be for anything.
Well, you know,
that's
birthday,
what he wanted to move towards.
His birthday was on the 15th, and I was just, you know, tweeting out his quotes, and I actually found some new ones that I hadn't come across before. And he actually even evolved beyond Pan-Africanism, and mm-hmm. he talked about the coalition of the oppressed.
Right. Yes.
Saying
I
that oppressed people
that
everywhere. He was saying that we need to identify with oppressed people everywhere, no matter where they will be, because he sees a struggle between the oppressed and the oppressor. And so yep. to me, an oppressed person can be anybody of any color, of any ethnic persuasion,
absolutely.
Of any gender, and the oppressor can be of any color, any, you know what I'm mm-hmm. saying? So, yeah.
What he came to understand was that, like you said, all skin folk ain't kin folk, you know? And regardless of, and I mean, he experienced that firsthand just with the people who killed him. And then the assistance that some of our people gave to the FBI and other, you know, bossy agents and all these other people who were, you know, terrorizing him and following him and harassing his family and threatening his life. So, yeah, that he definitely came to that understanding. And that was, I think, a major part of his evolution that really got him killed. Because even if you read the Judas Factor, the plot to kill Malcolm X, when he was planning to go to the United Nations, he had people from Asia, he had Asian countries, he had all over the African continent, he had Caribbean countries, he had all these different oppressed groups that he was able to bring together under one accord, understanding that they all had the same problem and they needed to address a human rights issue, not a civil rights issue. And that's what really got him taken up out of here. And they make it emphatically clear in that book by Carl Evans. I think it's probably the best research book on
Ross, just one minor correction, because I just posted one of his uh-huh. quotes the other day. Malcolm uh-huh. X actually believed in civil rights. once.
Oh yeah,
yeah. He
oh yeah.
He,
I'm not saying he didn't. Had, I'm just saying that when he did the when he went
but,
to gather the international group, it was a human rights
right exactly exactly
struggle that he was taking on an international stage. The civil rights was definitely because I mean we're in this country, so we have to fight for our rights in this country. You know, but when he took it global, that's when he got everyone on one accord. The things that happened to us in our
and even Martin Luther King agreed with that
were human rights atrocities that need to be addressed in international court.
Right.
And yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Even Martin Luther King, you know, moved to that phase as they were coming closer together, which is another reason why I feel like the system facilitated taking them out. You know, and when I say the system facilitated. I do believe the U.S. government was behind the assassination of Martin Luther King. I mean, they came out in a court case, but, you know, I had this other person tell me, oh, the NYPD murdered Malcolm. I was like, no, you're not finna tell that lie. And I said the NYPD knew about the assassination plot, and they did nothing to stop it, but we know who killed Malcolm.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hey,
man, I'm sorry. I got y'all off topic, man.
No. Now that's actually I was just finna ask you, Scotty. Yo, is there any kind of way that we could just have a maturation of Malcolm X? I mean, you so thoroughly engulfed into it. I have a lot of questions myself. I was just enjoying the conversation. But we do have to get we have to 40-minute mark, and I want to get this information out about the Ethiopians in South America. I think that's something.
I talked about that earlier. I want to touch on something else. Actually, it's something I found in this book is called "The History of the African Olmec: Black Civilizations of America from Prehistoric Times to the Present Era" by Paul Barton, and he's a Black Caribbean historian. He's also of indigenous descent and also Ethiopian descent. And he wrote this text, and it's really quite fascinating what he has here, but I'm just going to read a brief section from page number 3. It says, in his address to the Smithsonian, Van Sertima points out that Maya oral tradition describes artifacts and materials brought to Mexico by people who most likely came from West Africa. Quote, these things came from the east, meaning east of the Gulf of Mexico, from the other side of the water and the sea. They came here. They had their thrones, their little benches and stools. They had their parasols and their bone flutes, unquote. These items are still very common in West Africa and are used by chiefs, kings, noblemen, and their entourages. Such items are symbols of power and influence. In fact, golden stools or replicas are still carried by the Ashanti Nation of Ghana, along with large multicolored umbrellas, flutes of bone and ivory, as well as trumpets and horns of the same material. So this is basically what the Mayan people told them, and then he's confirming these things still are used in West Africa to this day. And that's just one thing. Then let me see. Okay, so this other section on page 4 says there are 3 periods which cover the history of Ghana. The first period was a continuation of a prehistoric civilization which existed in the Sahara during the wet phase, when much of the extended lake covered the areas had given away to dry, fertile, forest-covered terrain. A culture which practiced agriculture and were connected to the Mende-speaking people existed in West Africa. That same culture developed into a great civilization between 3000 BC and 400 AD and continued to exist up until about 1000 AD. It was from this Ghana during the periods mentioned that most of the ancient blacks whose likeness still exists in Olmec stonework of Mexico sailed from Africa to Mexico. Ghana's earliest roots began in the region of Mauritania from about 15,000 years ago. New information places a civilization called the Zinj Empire in the region at this very ancient period. During more recent times, between 10,000 BC to 3,000 BC, the Mende agricultural complex and the Niger-Congo language family developed. This development was followed soon afterwards by the Nok civilization, which placed an emphasis on highly technical and fine works of terracotta art, ironware, weapons and utensils, cotton cloth and textiles, gold and gold ornaments, weapons and currency. Civilization in this region continued into the Renaissance phase of the Ghana civilization, which was perhaps between 400 BC to 1000 AD. a very long period. Nigerian officials have dated some of the ancient terracotta works of the Nok region, which spread its influence all over Western Africa to about 2700 BC, according to the book The General History of Africa. And then they get into the origins of the Olmec. So, let me see. Okay. I know there was something I wanted to get into regarding the head. Because it was, oh, okay, I think I found it. Yes, okay. I think I found it here. Okay, so it says, to the extent to which, and this is on page 52, to the extent to which and the amount of trade carried out between the Americas and West Africa is not fully known, particularly among this early period of African Americas, including all peoples of African descent in the Americas from Alaska to Argentina. Their history yet, there's a wide variety of clues when research into the Olmec and to the Mandinka period of African history in the Americas is applied. For example, physical evidence of the black occupation and presence in parts of the Americas include artwork with distinctly Negritic features and evidence of the transportation of iron tools and artifacts to the Americas from West Africa, such as the bag of iron beads found buried near one of the colossal Olmec heads in Mexico. These iron beads were determined to have been placed in the location where they were found about 1100 BC, the approximate date that the heads were carbon dated to. Most dating of iron artifacts are estimated age given by most non-African archaeologists in the past have been roughly about 500 to 600 BC, a period which coincides with the Nok culture. Yet recent datings and evidence clearly indicates that iron smelting and working was carried out on a large scale before 1500 BC and on a smaller scale between 2600 BC to about 6000 BC. Furthermore, the Nok culture itself existed as early as 3000 BC to 2700 BC, according to Nigerian archaeologists. West Africans and the Africans portrayed in the 22 colossal heads of basalt rock and found in Mexico may have also created thousands of terracotta figurines and naturalistic busts of Negritic black Africans. These Africans were also responsible for the building of the earliest mound pyramids and other massive monuments built in Mesoamerica, the U.S., and other parts of the Americas. These constructions may have been built with the cooperation of Native Americans of the Mongoloid race. The construction of these massive monuments of clay brick and later on of stone, as well as the perfect carving of Negroid African features out of hard basalt stone, may have required the use of iron tools. Thus, it is very likely that the iron tools were introduced to the Americas by Africans, along with the copper and bronze implements. So they're talking about these people bringing their culture of iron smelting and the tools over here to assist them in carving out these giant heads. Now, where is it? I think
you also had one about the giant heads over in Africa, didn't you?
Yeah, I was trying to find it because there's a section where he talks about where Van Sertima actually talks about that they had giant heads over there too. And I'm trying to find it now. I think it might be in my other. Let me see if I can pull this one up here. That's about the penalty snap. Okay, let's see what this is.
Yeah, I couldn't find it in the actual book. Okay. That's something that we'll have to get to next time.
I found something else that I wanted to build on in regards to the gold tip spears. So this is from African Presence in Early America by Dr. Van Sertima, page 184. Mandinka traders and settlers in the Americas. Black men who brought those golden spear points to Hispaniola or Haiti were the Manding or Saracoles, also known in early times as Mandinga or Caragoles or Caragolese. The identical nature of the Saracole and Caragoli is explained through the Mende interchange of S and K, hard C in this case. Father Ramon Payne, one of the first of 12 missionaries to visit the Americas after Columbus's quote-unquote discovery, states that the black African gold merchants who came to Hispaniola were called black Guanini. Rafanese asserts that Guanini implies the golden tribe, or in other words, black merchants who trafficked in gold. The significance in West Africa, as we have seen, is the same. Guanini is of the traditional, the Guanini of the traditional histories of America do not deceive us, intermarried with another black tribe called the Calicoes or the Calicoles, who occupied a portion of Hispaniola or Haiti. They later diffused throughout the Lesser Antilles and the northern shores of South America up to the Isthmus of Panama. The American Guanini and Calicoles were the same as their Mandinka counterparts in West Africa. Leo Weiner, one of the first to single out the Mandinka as the black merchant seamen who crossed the Atlantic to pre-Columbia America, claims that they did so in less than 50 expeditions. If these alleged expeditions in any way approach the size of those initiated by Abubakar II, then West African impact on pre-Hispanic America must have been tremendous. To be sure, the Mandinka had been in Panama so long before the arrival of Europeans that the Labe Brasseur de Bourbourg, an expert on Middle American traditions, classed them as indigenous to the area. He wrote, "It is thus that today we distinguish the indigenous people of Darien, which is Panama, under two names, the Mandinkas and the Tule, whose difference perhaps yet recalls their distinct origins. These Mandinka were the remnants of a colony of blacks from Upper Guinea who may have been shipwrecked in Darien, when Darien is the name for Panama. Both the Gomara and Marta, while recording the activities of Balboa in 1513, noted their presence. Gomara tells us that when Balboa entered the province of Careca, he found no gold, but some black slaves belonging to the king of the place. Having asked this king where he obtained these black slaves, he, Balboa, received as an answer that the people of color lived quite near to there and that they were constantly at war with them," unquote. Gomara adds that these blacks were entirely like the blacks of Guinea, unquote. Peter Martyr's account of the same events differs but slightly. He states, "They found that in Careca, black slaves having come from a region a distance of only 2 days' march, in which produces people of that color fierce and above all cruel. It is believed that such blacks came long ago from Africa with the intention of robbing, and that having been shipwrecked, established residence in those mountains. These statements, when interpreted in the light of the previous mentioned maritime ventures, explain the origin of the Mandinka in this area. The martyr account, however, should more appropriately read trading instead of robbing." So, of course, you know, racism had to come into play. So that's what they're basically addressing. So this is basically talking about the people who were trading gold tip spears, and that name Guanini is a variant of the name Guinea, because Guinea is that term for gold. So they were known as the gold tribe, or the people who traded in gold.
Well, you know, I wanted to just let you go through that. I know we've been talking about this for the last few weeks, just the relationship between Africa and America, and just with your thorough history, you know, it's amazing just to find some of these things out, just to even find some of the literature that you could dive deeper into. So we appreciate, I appreciate that. Let me say that. I appreciate that. And the great questions, Scotty, you know.
Absolutely. And I like that he clarified that the whole autochthonous versus indigenous and aboriginal, because that's something we've talked about quite a bit as far as the misuse of those terms and just not fully grasping the ramifications of when you use those terms and them not being accurate like that. So. I appreciate that, but that's something that I think just needs to be addressed just in general, just to make sure that we do use the correct terms, because that is exceptionally important. One word can change the entire context or meaning of, you know, whatever you're trying to say. So I appreciate you for that, Scotty, for sure.
Well, even more than that, just to identify that we're all using the same definitions, that way we are part of the same conversation. Absolutely. Because it does no good for me to have a definition and Scotty to have a definition, and we're trying to have a conversation, we'll both be confused. So to pay attention to the definition of these words is greatly needed, to say the least. But with that being said, man, y'all did y'all thing. I just had to sit back and just absorb. Hopefully the listeners felt the same way and they got some good information out of tonight's show. We have gotten down to the end of it, though, Brother Rise.
Yes, sir.
It's that time. It's that time.
Yes, sir. So we'll do the prayer and then start to close it out. Again, thanks to everybody for being with us again later on tonight. It was great to be able to build with everyone, and hopefully you do find constructive value. And we'll have some great shows coming up, too. But this one was definitely great, and I loved just being able to build and get clarification on some things. And, I appreciate you all just for being with us tonight. So we'll say the prayer now and close it out. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times and all places, each and every time that we are in contact with another black person. It has been time to replace white supremacy with justice ASAP. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is I am. The all can I can. The all does I do. Thanks again for being with us. Stay safe this week. Wish you all the best. Stay safe, and hopefully you have a prosperous and healthy one. And we'll see you next week. Peace and love.
Yeah, we'll see you next week. And don't forget to check out Scotty on Friday.
Absolutely.
That's going to be awesome. Thank you again, too, Scotty.
Thank you, guys.
What up, son?
What's good, Dad?
Billie Holiday said a long time ago, no two people on earth are alike, and it's got to be the same way in music. Otherwise, it isn't music. Always remember, never follow the crowd. I have something important to tell you, and I'm going to let you know.
What it is.
I believe in revolution.